All right. Well, welcome everyone to the M211 podcast. We have an amazing guest today, Alex Cotran, the CEO and co-founder of the AI Education Project, also known as AIEDU. Personally, I'm just honored that Alex is joining us. Alex is truly who introduced me to the world of AI. Was fortunate to be on Zoom with him back in 2021, 2022, and really honored to attend a summit in Washington, D.C. in early 2023. And I truly think that was the genesis for my passion in AI. So, Alex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, yeah, such a pleasure. Been cool to watch you sort of like delve deeper and deeper into the space as well.
I appreciate it. For those that don't know, Alex, I think one of your superpowers is really building a coalition, bringing together the right people to push and advance AI literacy and AI initiatives. But could you just briefly share a little bit of your background? Kind of how did you get where you are today as the CEO of AIEDU?
So my background's in political organizing, not in tech, which is, I think, is actually really important for our genesis. So started my career in politics, worked on President Obama's reelection campaign, then went to DC. I was doing political stuff for the first part of my career and left DC after the second administration, came to San Francisco and found myself working for an AI company called H5. Most people have not heard of H5 unless you work for like one of the big law firms. It was a company that basically pioneered the use of language models in the legal sector. And I was hired to basically, you know, stand up a corporate social responsibility strategy for this AI company. It was about 250 people, so sort of like mid-size. And so we were doing things like AI governance, AI ethics, specifically around the use of AI in the law. And as part of that, we were doing judicial training. So basically training judges to better understand what is AI, how is it sort of manifesting in courtrooms. And so I have no background in education, but my parents are educators. And in sort of the process of doing all this crazy stuff, we were, you know, traveling the world, you know, hosting these training sessions and seminars all over places like NYU and Stanford. I was just on the phone with my mom at one point, and I was telling her about this, you know, we just trained a bunch of judges, and you should have seen how, you know, their minds were blown, you know, some of the stuff that we were sharing with them. And my mom sort of offhand mentioned like, oh, well, you should come to my school and talk to my kids about AI. And it was sort of a true, one of the true light bulb moments in my career, because I just had this sort of visceral reaction. It was like, well, what do you mean you're not talking to your kids about AI? And I actually was like first incredulous. I was like, well, you must be sort of talking about the future of work. Maybe you're not saying AI specifically. And she's like, no, we, you know, our English teacher is the person who does all of our career exploration. She's like, I don't know what AI is. I'm sure my students don't know what AI is. Our teachers don't know what AI is. And that was this moment of realization, this light bulb, where, as it turns out, even though the technocrats and the technologists were certain that AI is this wave of the future, and the way that we were talking about artificial intelligence, even back in 2018, this was a conversation about the future of work, the fourth industrial revolution. This was going to be the wave of the future, and there was like a certainty with which people were talking about this technology, and yet the future workers were not having the same conversation. And so the first part of this journey was figuring out, well, maybe my mom's school, Akron Public Schools, which is sort of an outlier. So I tried to see if there were other schools that I could point her to see if, you know, maybe there's curriculum that she could reference. And the more I looked, the more I realized that this was not unique to Akron, Ohio. This was actually a national problem. There was no sort of broadly accessible curriculum out there. And that became sort of an obsession of mine. It was this idea that, you know, if this technology is such a big deal, you know, this can't just be something that the CEOs of tech companies and, you know, the nerds are privy to. Like, we actually need to be having this conversation with everybody else, because clearly the impacts are going to touch everybody, not just techies. And so our work is really all about how do you bring that conversation to this really broad, you know, sort of set of this really broad set of audiences, and how do we talk about AI and communicate and sort of teach people about artificial intelligence in a way that's relevant and actionable. And so this was all before ChatGPT, and what ChatGPT did for us, as you can imagine, it took what was previously a relatively esoteric conversation, you know, sort of looking relatively far into the future, you know, like this eventually AI is going to be a big deal, and there were a small number of people who bought into it. Most people just sort of rolled their eyes. ChatGPT comes out, and, you know, suddenly this became very much something that people could touch and feel. And it really just expanded the the scope of, you know, folks who felt like this was actually worthy of their time. And we've been riding the wave ever since. And I guess I should say the work that we do is all about, you know, how do you actually get kids to have to, how do you build AI readiness and AI literacy with teachers and students? And, you know, our solution was and is all about, you need to get this in front of every single student, in front of captive audiences of students, so that they're not being forced to opt in. And so this has to get into core subjects. And so we basically build curriculum that plugs into English, science, math, social studies. And we do teacher training, a lot of professional development programs, but not just for teachers, but for systems. So, you know, administrators, you know, superintendents, everybody within the sort of within a system that has, you know, some way of like getting this knowledge and these skills in front of kids.
Now, you may not know it, Alex, but you're actually the reason that this podcast exists. So Brett and I actually met when I was a keynote speaker at the Ohio Summit last year, which I believe you were a main driver behind getting those Ohio AI teacher summits organized. And that's where Brett and I actually met and struck up a friendship and found our shared passion. So thank you for that. We're all here sitting around this virtual table because of you, and we're thrilled to have you join us.
Yeah, I think that's the, well, first of all, that's amazing. And I think that's the secret to our success has been about, it's AI is a technology, and it's creating opportunities, but also lots of challenges. But there, I think, you know, there is this assumption that the only way to solve a challenge that technology creates is with technology. And actually what we believe is that this is very much a human driven solution. And the only way for us to actually solve this problem of how do you like sort of expand access is to provide a platform for more people to be a part of it. And I think not only is it okay that technologists aren't the only ones having these conversations, I think it's actually critical that that folks who are driving this work are not technologists, because there's just so much to education that technologists don't understand and won't understand. And they need folks who have been living and breathing the work of education to also help us figure out how do we address the very specific needs that educators and schools have.
Alex, we're about to kick off our AMP to 11 questions, and you once self-described yourself. I saw you speak at the ASU GSV Summit, and you said, "I'm like that nerdy cousin at the Thanksgiving table who just wants to keep showing you cool things. And what's the state of AI?" And I think that is like exactly what we hope our listeners hear today from you, is these questions are geared to kind of have you share what are the things right now that make you excited or fearful of AI, and what are some of the tools or people that our listeners should know about, because not everyone does have the opportunity to get to connect with you or hear you in person. So that's really what we hope today is about. First one, we're going to get pop culture. We're going to start and end with pop culture. First, the Netflix hit Stranger Things, right? There's a character named Eleven, has these supernatural powers. They leave everyone in awe the first time they see or experience her. So, Alex, what's your most jaw-dropping AI moment? The first thing that you encountered that really made you see something unexpected or out of this world?
Yeah, I think there's like two specific moments. I mean, the first is just ChatGPT. I know that's like a boring answer, but I think it really is profound. The idea that, you know, I started my career as a writer and working in communications. So all I did was write stuff. And even though this is a GPT 3.5, sort of the older version of ChatGPT before GPT-4 that most people have experience with now, seeing this technology just write like a really competent, not amazing, but fully competent stuff, with relatively basic prompts was, you know, I think it was mind blowing. And it was also this key moment, almost like an inflection point where this was clear. This was now going from a theoretical of like, oh, this is a technology that eventually is going to be able to do stuff that's going to really change the way we live and work, to this is now changing the way we work. And a lot of I suspect a lot of my responses are really going to anchor on ChatGPT, just because it is such a multifaceted tool. And, you know, ChatGPT, you can insert Gemini, insert, you know, Claude, like any one of the language models. They're all relatively good and at a sort of similar level of competency. I would say the other one is AI art. You know, generative AI is not the same thing as language models, but, you know, functionally, they really kind of like had their maturation point at the same time. And, you know, likewise, being able to just type in a phrase and have these sort of incredible, you know, illustrations and you know, art that just sort of created in front of your eyes, and, you know, going down the rabbit hole of just like playing around with that and seeing what you can make. It's addicting. And And once again, it's just this, you know, as someone, I used to be a professional photographer, and it was very cool to see, you know, imagery that, you know, previously, you know, I could imagine myself taking weeks to try to get to an end product that I was now able to create with a single sentence. And there's obviously concerns that come from that, but certainly that was a mind-blowing moment in sort of like early on in the journey. And I think, you know, ever since then, it's been on the margins. You know, there've been changes to the models and new tools coming out, but I think all of them ultimately are sort of iterating on sort of like that core experience of, you know, you have this idea, you have this task, you have this thing that you need help with, and you can just sort of like ask for it and get an output that, you know, let's say 6 times out of 10 is actually good enough. And maybe 1 time out of 10 is amazing. And maybe 3 times out of 10 is really bad, but just that sort of like creative experience of like making with technology, it sort of bridged, you know, previously technology sort of lived in the echelons of nerds and techies, right? And so to really, you know, people who are doing, you know, experts in computer science, you know, they were able to have that experience, you know, just by writing code and seeing their video games or programs come to life. But it's an experience that I had never had, that most people sort of only hear about or like sort of learn about sort of like from the outside. And sort of what language models have done and what generative AI has done is it's given a much, much wider gamut of people that experience of sort of like using technology to make and create. And I think we're still sort of reckoning with like even the early days of what that's going to mean for everybody, for education, but also just for the way that folks like us do our work day to day.
And I know that, as you said, right, ChatGPT, everyone has to preface now with like, I know that's boring or that's outdated, but as you said, you got to sometimes pay respect to what really put AI into the zeitgeist and the pop and into culture. Our next question, let's see if there's a different tool that's in your toolbox around AI. But we got the name for AMP211 from Spinal Tap, right? That iconic scene, right? The amp cranks up to 11. It's going to push you past the limits of the ordinary when you really need that extra oomph. So what are some tools you're using right now or our listeners should know about when you really need to like get things done or you really need to think outside the box or do something different? How are you getting to your absolute limits when you're using an AI tool, for example?
Thinking outside the box, you know, I still think ChatGPT is where I would start and end. I mean, there's, you know, what I would caution people about is there's lots of wrappers out there. So Magic School is an example of this. There's lots of wrappers and tools that will allow you to do stuff, but really all those tools are doing in general is they're sort of templatizing the process of prompt engineering. And so ultimately, if you're trying to figure out how can I use AI to the fullest, I mean, just mastering ChatGPT or Gemini or Claude is probably the best sort of single thing for you to focus on. That being said, there's a tool that I've been using increasingly, and I actually have a Substack that I'm going to be posting about this later today called Granola AI. And this is actually, I think, and what I'm writing about in my Substack is, you know, it's sort of one of the first times that I've really had this sort of like insight into like what it's going to look like for AI to augment and amplify sort of human work. Granola is a note-taking app. And so you're like, well, there's actually lots of note-taking AI tools. There's Firefly. There's, I think Zoom has sort of built-in note-taking. And in most note-taking apps, you know, it records a session, sort of like summarizes based on the transcript, and you get sort of the summary of notes. And, you know, that's often fine. Usually it misses stuff. I find that most people, if they're being really honest, they're not actually even using the notes that much. Because part of the challenge with some of these like automated note-taking apps is the process of note-taking is not, it's as much about the process as the endpoint. You know, like the process of like actually writing the notes during the meeting, it's a way of, you know, helping you to remember things and also like anchoring sort of like what's important. So what Granola does is it basically looks just like Apple Notes, you know, regular text editor. And so you go into a meeting and you sit down and you take notes the way you would normally take notes. And it records a transcript. It doesn't record the audio. It just transcribes the meeting. And then what it does is it fills in the gaps. So you take a meeting, you write, let's say like 8 to 10 lines of text capturing sort of like what the key pieces are, but you're not necessarily like transcribing every single piece of the meeting. And so it basically uses the notes that you take as like a structure and then fills in all the details. So you basically get the notes that you would take with all this sort of like augmented with all this other, you know, context and details that you might miss if you're not literally like sitting down and just like feverishly writing notes. And so what it means is I can spend more time actually focusing on the meeting as opposed to worrying about like, did I capture this important, you know, tidbit or, you know, bullet point. And it's also, you know, helped me understand, like, we have people on my team who, you know, in many cases, they're joining meetings just to take notes. And one of the challenges that we have is, you know, for junior members of the team, you know, we want them to have more opportunities to participate in meetings and contribute, but they're also expected to take, you know, really high quality notes. And it's very hard to take notes and also then have like the mental space to then like, you know, think of a clever sort of thing to weigh in on. And you're worried that you might miss capturing the notes if you do that. And so it hasn't replaced the human note taker, because we still need somebody to actually be sort of like driving the car, as it were, taking the notes, but it sort of like lowers the amount of time that they have to spend like literally taking notes. And so it, and it also gets lots of stuff wrong. And so you have to have somebody doing it. You know, if it's really bad at like numbers, for example. And so I was actually using Granola to prep for a board meeting where we're going through our budget. And, you know, a lot of the budget numbers, it just got wrong because of, I think, the transcript. And so the other insight there is, you know, with these tools, there's still an important role for people in the equation. Attempting to like fully replace somebody with Granola, I think, is like a failed endeavor. And so I think for me, that takeaway is like, okay, this is now help me understand what we mean by like AI augmenting as opposed to replacing people. Is it's a tool that is best implemented in the hands of a capable human. That human has to understand the limitations, because they have to play this role of like providing that oversight. But the outcome is that they're now able to spend more time doing the more creative, strategic work that we need people to be doing. And, you know, in the case of meetings, like being able to actually participate in, let's say, build a relationship with somebody. So Granola AI, it's definitely my new favorite tool, at least for now.
I appreciate it. And that's the kind of things where I hope if Rebecca says she doesn't know a tool, that means you're really on the right track here. And this is an amazing opportunity to learn from you. But I love the fact that you gave an example of a use case where, you know, you as a CEO or as someone who leads a team, this great happy medium of giving more access to your team to be more present, but also having a backup plan, but also making sure they understand how to utilize it. So thank you. That's an exact example of a great use case here. Because you have not only so much experience with AI and tools that are out there, but also because of, as you mentioned, your role previously in politics and building coalitions, especially with like mission-aligned orgs, I'm going to let you, when I give these examples of questions, feel free to replace an AI tool with like an AI or mission-aligned org to what you're doing. We are always used to rating something as 10 out of 10, but sometimes there's something that's just so good, it's off the charts, we're calling it an 11 out of 10. So what's either an AI tool that you feel is an 11 out of 10 and why, or what is an org that's doing something really amazing that deserves an 11 out of 10?
I honestly don't think there's any tool that's an 11 out of 10. I mean, I guess it depends on sort of like the rating system, right? So I think Granola would be an example of a tool that, you know, has been, you know, maybe an 11 out of 10 in terms of just the wow factor and sort of like the way that it's sort of like changed my day to day. And like, it's actually lived up to, you know, there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of conversation about, oh, these AI is going to transform the way we work. My actual experience with ChatGPT is sometimes yes, but sometimes it just hallucinates. And sometimes it's just getting stuff wrong, or it's just average, or even maybe slightly below average. I think Granola is amazing because it has a very specific purpose, and it has specific sort of a user interface and sort of a UX that's designed to best employ the human, the role of the human. But as I said, it gets a lot of stuff wrong. And, you know, I'm even not 100% sure that, you know, the big question for me whenever I'm using a tool is this something that I would want everybody on my team using? And even with Granola, I think the answer is probably yes. But because of the limitations, because it, for example, gets things, you know, numbers wrong, there will have to be a lot of training that we will have to roll out if we're going to be instructing people to rely on it. And I think there's really no tool out there that doesn't have some kind of a limitation like that. You know, another, you know, potential 11 out of 10 with similar caveats is Notebook LM. Brad, I'm sure you've heard of Notebook LM. This is basically a tool from Google that helps you do research, and it can, you know, does a really clever job compiling different sources. And you can upload a research paper and it'll sort of turn it into a podcast. I haven't necessarily seen it used in a way that's truly useful. I mean, I think the challenge that a lot of these AI tools have is most of the times that I see them used, they're used almost like as demonstration cases for what AI could eventually do. But I haven't really seen somebody, you know, like run a PD, for example, using Notebook LM as a replacement for like a human instructor. And I think that's just because a human instructor is still way better than AI. And I think in general, like humans are still way better than the AI. So the tools that really are interesting to me are ones that are helping people do that work more effectively and more efficiently, perhaps. The AI art's really cool too. I have a lot of qualms with it, but I mean, I no longer have to use boring stock photography for stuff. And I can kind of like have like literally whatever the thing is that I want for a slide, I can like dream it up and just have that exact thing that was maybe not the exact thing, was like really sort of like aligned to what I was imagining.
What's your image generation platform of choice right now?
I use Midjourney, mostly because I just haven't had the time to learn the other tools. I also haven't gotten access. I haven't even played around with Sora yet. That's probably another mind-blowing. I guess I should actually go back and say, you know, one of the other truly mind-blowing moments was text-to-video and seeing the stuff coming out of Sora. And then there's other tools, I think, out there that's like Runway ML does something similar. You know, they're not perfect at all. Like they're a lot of the videos that we see in sort of the demos, it's hard to get to that level of quality. And you know, I guess your mileage may vary as sort of a user. But the idea that we may be heading towards a world where, you know, video content could just be whatever is in your imagination, just translated, you know, at the tip of your fingers without having to hire, you know, VFX artists and actors is interesting. I don't know if it's cool. That could be really bad, actually. And I worry about a world where we sort of like, you know, displace artists with this like common denominator of like quite good, but ultimately kind of averaged out visuals. But that the fact that we can do it with just a string of text is freaking amazing.
And funnily enough, you bring up Notebook LM. We were fortunate enough to reconnect recently at Google headquarters in the Bay Area. And you bring up Notebook LM for PD. That is, stay tuned, Alex, because that is something that we're excited about, that we'll be talking about how you can bring Notebook LM and have that really turbocharge a PD or an AI summit like the ones we referenced in Ohio this year.
And I've actually run some PDs specifically on Notebook LM, and I'm doing student work right now, and I use it a lot as a student, and it's probably my biggest game changer tool in my box right now, that's for sure. So
another tool that I was not a big user of until recently, and I know Rebecca has been for a while, but here at Amp211, we're big fans of 11 Labs. So that's just a coincidence, but it's an amazing tool. And it's known for obviously creating AI voices that are truly amazing and replicate some of, you know, the most famous people in the world. So Alex, you could have anyone's voice, historical, fiction, living, dead, reading your daily emails or being your AI voice. Who would it be and why?
Probably Michael Fassbender. I'm an Anglophile. I just think British people sound cool. My husband's British, so I'm obviously biased in that way. And I think Michael Fassbender has this like a very calming, authoritative. I mean, his performance in the Steve Jobs movie was amazing. I will say I've developed an ear for the AI voice. It's actually kind of hard sometimes to really catch it. You know, if you go on YouTube or Instagram or TikTok, I found that now maybe 50% of the reels or the shorts or the TikToks are narrated by an AI voice. And it kind of drives me crazy because I just worry about a world where, you know, because it's so good and because it's actually kind of hard and sometimes I'm not totally sure. Yeah, I do worry about a world where, you know, it becomes harder and harder to actually know if you're communicating or interacting with, you know, real or generated content. And so I think for that reason, we actually don't use 11 Labs as much just because it's, you know, it feels like the jury's still out on like what the norms should be. And obviously with, you know, using celebrity voices, I don't even think 11 Labs will let you. I think Udly will catch it. and prevent you. But and yet there are actually some celebrities who are like openly saying, oh, I want people to use my voice and, you know, use it to create and sort of iterate. And there are others that are like, you know, vehemently against it. So it's, you know, kind of like in the zeitgeist right now. And I guess we're going to have to figure this out together as a society as to like what's appropriate and what's not. But yeah, Michael Fassbender. It's cool.
Yeah, that's a new one. That's well played. I said Adele. I also love a good British or English accent that's just different than the typical American one. Okay, here's something that I've heard you actually, I've always been impressed because, again, you're usually on the cutting edge and you've experienced a lot with AI. You've often said something like, you know, this is the worst version of AI we're ever going to experience. So as we keep climbing closer to like really peaking and hitting an 11 on the innovation scale with AI, what's like a gap right now in AI that you can't, like you find yourself saying like, well, how come we don't know how to do this yet? Like what's a skill or something that you assumed AI would be able to generate at this point that you still find like they're just not doing a very good job of?
While you're thinking about it, I thought of one today. I'm wondering why we can't predict the weather very well yet. Like, how is there not an AI tool? Because again, I was in Europe as you were, Alex, and the weather was wrong every day. I feel like there should be now that we have AI, we should be better at that. But I'm curious as to what yours is.
So I think summarization is an example of, it's one of the use cases that I often will hear about ChatGPT. It's like, oh, ChatGPT, one of the great ways to use ChatGPT, you know, upload a research paper and it'll summarize it for you. And for people who are trying to digest, who have jobs that aren't just digesting research, you know, it's a way of sort of staying current. So there's two challenges to this. The first is that it just gets it wrong or hallucinates or truncates. So like the hallucination part is like, it'll obviously just like make up stuff. And the only way to know if it hallucinated is to have read the research or to have read whatever it is that you're asking it to summarize. So the fact that there's a, not just a non-zero, but a relatively large, like a percentage of the time that it's hallucinating, basically means that in order to use it effectively, you have to read the research paper anyways. And so then the question is, are you really saving that much time if you're still being forced to read the research paper? And if you're not reading the research paper, is it, I mean, maybe that's just like a thing that you say is like, well, I don't really care if it's wrong 20% of the time. I'd rather like know 80% of the research. But I think most people would sort of react to that and say, well, there's something sort of problematic if people are sort of, you know, peddling summaries of research that, you know, may or may not actually be true. But then the bigger challenge, and I think this comes back to even my like observation about granola and like note-taking is, you know, it's one of my board members is a former partner at a really big law firm. She has her own company now and she does a lot of, you know, presentations. These are like very niche, like arcane subject matter, right? So she goes and presents at like the Financial Services Association and she's talking about sort of like AI ethics implementation and like regulatory policy around use of AI in financial services. And she was telling me about how she's, oh, I've got to cram and get like a presentation ready for, you know, this keynote that I'm doing. And I said, oh, well, why don't you use, and there's like some, there was some like really sort of long white paper that she had to read in order to prep. And I told her, like, well, why don't you use ChatGPT to kind of like help you create some of the bullet points? And she said, well, part of my process for going and delivering a presentation and being an authority on a topic is, you know, the process of reading and actually writing out my notes and writing out my talk track, that's actually how I get ready. And I think that was like a really, it was a big insight for me because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if someone's going to go and present, what we don't want is someone who's just memorizing bullet points that ChatGPT provided. You know, I think the most engaging presentations are ones where someone has actually internalized the knowledge and is, and sure, maybe there's a, that doesn't say that ChatGPT can't be useful, you know, like maybe you've read that research paper and, you know, hey, I need help with a interesting anecdote to open up my presentation with, right? So that I think there are ways, you know, Brett, to your question about like, how could you use this to sort of like enhance your creativity? You know, I think there are ways that you could use it, but it, you know, I think people will often be disappointed with, you know, the limits to how much it can actually, how much time it can actually save. Like this isn't about taking something that used to take 5 hours and letting you get it done in like 5 minutes. you know, maybe what used to take you 5 hours will take you 3 hours. And by the way, that's still great. And we should still be very excited about that. But I think it's a much less sexy and much less flashy thing to share. And so I'm often like a little bit circumspect about any application of AI that almost seems too good to be true. Now, that said, I think with coding, I think that there are certain applications where it can literally just replace time, like wholesale, and writing code is a good example of that. And writing press releases is another example of that, like instances where you're not actually looking for creative writing. You know, press release is often like a regurgitation of, you know, canned language that, you know, almost like the purpose of a press release is not to make up new ideas or new language, but just to sort of stick to talking points and messaging that have already been established. And I think for something like that, AI is actually quite good at. But still, you have to read it. You have to, you know, make it your own. People are, I think, increasingly going to start to recognize when something has been written or generated by AI. And I think organizations that lean too much on it are just going to come across as kind of like lame.
I think that's why Notebook LM has been such a game changer for me, like as a researcher and as like a student, because it has this capability where it will summarize a document for you, create a briefing doc, and then give you exact citations to which of your 50 documents it pulled the information from and take you right there, which has really kind of helped me check for hallucinations a lot faster than I could in ChatGPT. You know, I didn't necessarily trust that reg process in ChatGPT, but because Notebook LM can immediately tell you, show you the sentence and which document it pulled you from in exact time and make you a briefing doc with all the references, I think that's been a huge game changer for the exact reasons that you've mentioned, Alex. So thanks for bringing that up.
And something else you mentioned that is really important, I think, for our listeners and also resonated with me was this idea that if something should take you 5 hours, maybe it does save you an hour or two. And that's, you know, obviously the that's a great process. But something I've noticed, let's say there's things in the past that as an educator, there's certain things that would get me hung up. Like you said, searching for stock photos in a PowerPoint or even like formatting the bullets of a PowerPoint. Sometimes those would be like that would be like the wall or the bridge too far for me the night before I'm, you know, teaching. And so what I've noticed is while it might not save me time, it's really had me think about, well, what are the things I enjoy doing and what are things I have to do? And if it can help you get through the have to do's to get to the part that like you love and you're passionate about in your field, that's where I've noticed, like, I don't even care anymore if it saves me time. It makes it better, the experience for me. And hopefully, obviously, the output is equally as good, if not better. But that's where I'm like, when it lets me get through the part of the journey I don't really want to experience anymore, but you have to go through it first to even know which ones you like and don't like. So I hope that's also resonant with people out there, especially in the field of education.
But this is okay. So this is interesting because I'm going through, we're doing like sort of our annual reviews for our team. And one of the things that I had this sort of an internal struggle with is, you know, a really good use case for ChatGPT would be to just upload all of the, you know, have to go through all the peer feedback and like the manager, you know, skip level feedback and then like read through it, process it, and then sort of like synthesize that into my own feedback and review. And, you know, nobody likes writing reviews. It's sort of like, it's just, you know, it's a lot of work. And yet I do, you know, I, even though I could use ChatGPT to write my reviews for me, I think if I'm somebody who's receiving a review from a manager, I don't know how I would feel about them just using ChatGPT. And I think for education, it goes the same way. I think there are things that teachers could use ChatGPT for. Grading is a great example of this, but I do wonder about whether even if something is boring or annoying, you know, it's not that every time something is boring, it's critical. I think there are some things where, you know, so I think my reflection with the reviews is, you know, maybe, I've used ChatGPT to help me sort of like think about structurally how to structure the feedback and like what specific examples, let's say, to reference. But, you know, I made a point of making it my own. But Brett, the example that you gave, and this was actually in a PD that we delivered to a bunch of administrators in New York. And I remember one of your recommendations was, you know, for an observation where so much of the time is spent just sort of like, you know, taking notes from an observation, like sitting down and like writing that out into sort of like this, like, you know, and it's a process where, you know, the principal is not actually getting that one-on-one time with the teacher. They're just sort of sitting and writing. So can you use AI to actually, you know, if you're spending, let's say, 3 hours on an observation with a teacher, if AI means that you can now instead of spending 2.5 hours writing and 30 minutes coaching that teacher one-on-one, if you flip it and spend 30 minutes sort of like synthesizing using ChatGPT, maybe another 30 minutes sort of like reading and internalizing it, and then 2 hours for one-on-one time, I think that would be like a good outcome. So I think it's, you know, the onus is on educators, on whoever you are, to think about, you know, where do I have almost like a duty to, you know, deploy my human skills and the sort of like the special sauce of what makes humans so important to the equation. And then, yeah, what are the pieces that legitimately are, you know, better off, where everybody's better off from this being sort of automated?
Yeah, that's an excellent use case. And wow, whoever said that sounds brilliant. Wow, that's amazing. Something I've been fortunate, you know, I've seen you present at AI summits and get to interview, you know, current students, both in from elementary school all the way through college. So I've had the opportunity to watch you interact with people of all ages and talk about AI. But right now, for those 11-year-olds out there, right, they're going to live in a world, they're going to grow up never knowing what the world's like without AI at their fingertips. So for those students and those people out there today, what's a message you'd give them about the about their future in an AI-driven world, things to be cautious about or things they should be hopeful and optimistic about?
I suppose there's a lot to be cautious about. I don't know that there's, I don't know how much we gain from scaring kids who are 11 just because we don't have answers and we don't really know how, you know, what the world will actually look like. I think the first thing is, you know, be intentional about making space for like the human lived experience. And just because you can have a best friend that's an AI companion, just because you can sit down and use Midjourney to create art, you know, there's far greater rewards from spending time building human connections with people, from spending time learning how to draw or learning how to write. And, you know, it's weird because we never, that's something we didn't really have to tell kids, you know, it was, it's kind of a strange thing to say, like, you know, make time for the human experience or for being human. But I think that's actually going to be something that, you know, if we're not intentional about it, you could easily sort of fall into the trap of every part of your day sort of like being, you know, consisting of these, you know, artificial interactions, artificial experiences that might still be really engaging and interesting, but might be sort of hollow. And, you know, I think social media is a version of this, right? Like, just, you can spend 2 hours on TikTok and it's entertaining. It, like, it's really entertaining, almost maybe too entertaining. And you finish that 2-hour session and it's unclear, like, what you even saw. Like, you can't even put your finger on any one TikTok or reel. It's sort of just this amalgamation of just like stuff that kind of flowed over you. It was almost like a river of content. And I think, you know, that's just going to be amplified more and more as the quality of the generative AI gets better. And as sort of like in terms of the social norms around, or just the acceptability of, like, you know, I think Instagram is going to start rolling out like AI accounts, like fully AI accounts with their own followers. And kids are just going to have to kind of like be more intentional about it. And they may have to be more intentional even without parental guidance, because their parents might not even realize that they need to give them that advice. What I find is kids are way ahead of the teachers and us adults in terms of like, they've seen all the stuff.
You know, something, obviously, again, you were the creator of this. We were fortunate in 2024 in San Diego, having students kind of take the lead at the GSV Air Show, AI show. They got to create things and they had, you know, they had a room full of educators. And when we asked them who in this room has ever created something in line with an AI acceptable use policy, only those students on stage were the only ones who had ever done that before. So, you know, when we give these tools to students, they're much quicker to say, let me dive in, let me learn about this. So that's great that they're, you know, they're more forward thinking and willing to dive in sometimes, but I appreciate those that like caution to balance AI with reality, I guess would be the way to put it. For you, you know, I know that when you get to speak about these things, you know, the mission of AIDU, if you want to briefly touch on that, but we know the term 11-11 means we're going to make a wish, right? We're going to hope that something comes true. So it's 11-11 right now. What's one wish you kind of have about how AI could shape the future of education and society? What would that look like to you?
My wish would be that the excitement and flashiness of AI prompts us not to reorganize education around everybody using AI more, and rather to use it as a moment to double down on those like critical pieces of education that, you know, have fallen by the wayside with, you know, the obsessive focus on standards. And by that, I mean, you know, just being resilient and being a critical thinker and being creative and learning how to communicate and learning how to build relationships and find mentors and be flexible. You know, I think this is something we've talked about for so long. You know, this is, and in some ways, you know, I think this is very much back to the future, you know, like in the age of AI, what's so important? It's like, well, it's actually, you know, at AIEDU, when we talk about AI readiness, we are talking less about knowing how to prompt engineer ChatGPT, and rather we're talking more about, you know, the 21st century skills, many of which I already named, that have been something that we've discussed for years. I mean, this is like decades long conversations, right, about 21st century skills. And, you know, the good news is that, you know, we believe the skills are not new. So it's not that we have to totally, you know, it's not, we don't need a revolution in education per se. But the bad news is that we've been talking about these skills for decades, and we haven't necessarily made meaningful progress because the incentives are not aligned. Teachers are not measured on, are you building, on whether they're building critical thinking with their students. And so it's not teachers' fault. You know, like you go to a teacher and say, well, you need to do more critical thinking in the classroom. And they'll say, well, that's great, but I don't have time. You know, like I'm not given the time or support to do that. You know, what I'm being asked is to, you know, focus on a specific set of, you know, content standards. And so, yeah, so my wish is that, you know, this is a moment for education to become more engaged. And I think ultimately education needs to be more engaging. Kids are less and less bought in to education. I think in part because it doesn't feel relevant, and because content knowledge is less and less important in a world where you can just ask for anything and get it. And I think the project of actually adjusting education to focus more on these sort of intangibles of, you know, the human advantage, that makes for more engaging classrooms. And I think it makes for more well-rounded and better equipped students for the future. And so the question is whether we take this as a moment to do that, or whether this is just a moment to buy more tools. And right now it feels a little bit more like the tools are winning the day.
What advice would you have, Alex, for teachers and principals who are trying to figure out how to govern this or introduce guidelines and frameworks and rules for teachers and students? What advice would you have for those schools and districts?
Well, there's two things. So the first is that there are some sort of immediate guidelines and policies that you probably need to have in place. For example, academic integrity, and let's say just general guidelines around you know, student privacy and safety. And you know, AIEDU has published some guidelines that we created for the state of Ohio, which Brett, you've actually helped us to disseminate across the state. Those are available on our website. And those guidelines were actually built on the shoulders of a number of other recommendations and guidelines from organizations like TeachAI and ISTE, among many, many others that we've cited in our work. So I would say start by, you know, there's a lot of help already available. And so and in most cases, it's variations of the same thing. You know, I don't know that I've ever seen anything that's like wildly wrong. I think there's maybe like better and worse sort of ways of framing certain things. But I think the bigger challenge is, you know, you can have all those guidelines in place, but the real question, which is like, how do I make sure that my teachers and my students are set up for success? Sure, having an academic integrity policy is like, it's going to help you deal with some of like the complicated stuff that's going to happen when kids are using ChatGPT to write homework assignments. But that's not really going to address this bigger question of like, how do I make sure my kids aren't left behind in this world where AI is changing the way not just we teach and operate in schools, but the way we like live and work outside of school. And, you know, that comes from AI readiness. And really, and so the beauty of this is that we, you know, I don't know what tools to recommend to schools. Like, I don't know that there is a tool that I would say every school should be deploying district-wide yet. But what I do know is every single teacher at every single school should be going through some amount of AI readiness professional development. And that goes, and that's everybody from a gym teacher to an art teacher to a math, you know, social studies, science teacher to PD instructional leads to building principals to district superintendents. And so there's sort of it's the one unambiguous thing that schools can like double down on. And it's also the thing that requires the least amount of political capital, because, you know, schools may not have a budget line item for AI, but they have, you know, line items for professional development and digital readiness and, you know, IT. And so, you know, using that as an opportunity to sort of like lay that sort of like foundational primer. And once you have AI readiness and sort of like that literacy across the board, you're going to be the best equipped to A, implement and navigate the policies that you also need to have in place, because policies are useless if people don't understand the why behind them. But you're also going to be in the best position to start deploying tools as they sort of reach more technological maturity.
I think one of the things you're leading at AIDU that I've seen over the past few years especially is you have this top-down, bottoms-up approach. So like you said, district leaders need that cover. They need to make sure what they're doing is ethically and legally correct, because, you know, they have to make, that's their job in not just AI, but in general. But I've also seen you're really trying to build and democratize like AI literacy and access to it, because by having things like these AI summits in Ohio where it's free for all educators in the state to attend, you're making sure that people that might otherwise not have access or might not see innovation as quickly as other areas in the state or in the country, they have access to it. So again, I just want to say that's a really great approach, and it aligns with what you're saying. Getting everyone just to a baseline will really serve the needs of those students that that are in those communities. So thank you for leading that work and bringing so many stakeholders with you along that journey. And we are going to close with our final question. And so again, you know, with the work you lead, right, we're going to end with pop culture, right? In the film series Ocean's 11, the crew is able to pull off the impossible heist with this ultimate dream team. So, you know, you don't need to name 11 folks necessarily, but if you could think about the kind of people, organizations that are working together to tackle some of the biggest challenges in education along with AI, who are some of those people you're bringing along with you, those experts, specialists, or innovators that that you find are doing the greatest work in the space right now? Or you just want to recognize for others?
Yeah, no, there's more. I mean, there's a lot more than 11. So I'll just sort of rattle it off in no particular order. You know, I think there's a lot of organizations that have been doing the work of helping to prepare and advance education for the future, with a deep focus on teachers and building teacher readiness. And so, you know, Digital Promise, Leading Now, ISTE, All for Ed, and it's a much longer list, CS for All, CSTA, you know, these, I think what's so powerful about this moment is, you know, unlike with computer science, I mean, the computer science movement, you know, was, you know, kind of birthed, you know, out of thin air, and it was a lot of work, and we're still not even close to done in that effort. And by the way, I think we need to make sure that we don't allow ourselves to get distracted by AI as sort of like a new shiny object that, you know, because we still need to double down on computer science education. But with AI, we actually have now this ecosystem that we can tap and leverage. And so the first is just like that, you know, data science for all, you know, that ecosystem of organizations is critical. I think also just the teachers, the administrators, folks that know very little, maybe even nothing about AI, are definitely part of my team, because, you know, at the end of the day, prompt engineering is not that hard. It's like, how do you ask good questions? How do you just experiment? And in most cases, learning how to prompt engineer is just having a license to experiment and understanding sort of like what to look for. AI literacy is not actually that hard, right? It's like the basics of what everybody needs to know about AI is, it's relatively high level. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, being able to explain in detail, you know, how a language model is actually constructed. The really hard thing about AI readiness is, how do you actually implement this within a system? And so the people who don't know very much about AI are also people who really understand the challenge of how do you affect change within systems that are, by the way, dealing with incredibly complex challenges, you know, because AI was sort of dropped into everybody's lap in a moment where we were just in the process of digging ourselves out of all the learning loss from COVID. And we're dealing with, you know, record levels of absenteeism in schools and, you know, really significant challenges when it comes to math and English literacy. And so, you know, and those challenges are still there. And I don't know. I don't think that AI is just going to solve them. I think that's a fallacy that we're just going to like, we can just sort of like move on from those challenges and just focus on AI. So, and nobody in Silicon Valley understands those challenges, right? So like what I hope is an inspiring call to action for, you know, the educators and the administrators who are listening to this is, you know, nobody can do what you do. Nobody knows, you know, you are the deep expert when it comes to your district, your students, your teachers, your classrooms. And we need you at the table. We need you not just at the table, but, you know, active participants and sort of driving things forward. And, you know, the one thing that you need to do to help advance that is, you know, get yourself on that learning journey. And so, you know, just like as in Ocean's 11, you know, so much of that movie is spent them just learning about the casino, right? And learning about all the sort of like nooks and crannies of the security system. I mean, I think that's what this coalition needs to be doing is, you know, like getting smart on what is it that we need to know to actually accomplish this goal. But yeah, that's one of my favorite movies. So appreciate the the best pop culture reference yet.
Well, I should have prefaced that with spoiler alert, everyone. If you haven't seen this movie from the early 2000s, they rob a casino. But Alex, before I let you up the hot seat, you know, you said something really important that I do want to maybe ask you to give some flowers out there. You're right. There are some educators who may not be experts in AI, but who are embracing the challenge and trying to move the work forward. So, you know, in your work with AIDU, maybe can you highlight some of maybe whether it's people or districts or regions or states that you feel are really, you know, working in collaboration with you or others to push the work forward and to get more people at the table, especially in education?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've talked about the state of Ohio, and I think for good reason. Ohio is, you know, one of the leading states right now nationally. They have, you know, the lieutenant governor published a statewide strategy for AI education, and they've put their money where their mouth is in terms of like doubling down on now what is the second year of a really significant grant with AIDU, but really in partnership with the entire ecosystem of educational service centers across the state to provide professional development and sort of ongoing learning. And there are other states that are doing the same. You know, Colorado also comes to mind. There's been a sort of an AI working group led by the Colorado Education Initiative that we've been supporting. And then there's also districts, you know, like New York City Public Schools. You know, there's been a lot of change within that district, and yet they are still, you know, on the leading edge of experimentation and really, you know, centering the way that they think about AI readiness in terms of how it aligns to the existing learning goals that they have. And they have an amazing team of folks at New York City that have, you know, they have been on this learning journey for a long time and have a really, you know, well-informed perspective on what this looks like. You know, LAUSD as well. The list goes on. I mean, Brett, you're sort of more clued into this than me, but and then Gwinnett County Public Schools in Georgia. They were actually like the OG. I mean, Gwinnett County is the school district that, you know, way before ChatGPT, they sort of rolled out the swim snorkel scuba model for AI literacy, which is basically like everybody needs to learn how to swim. Some people will snorkel and a select few will scuba dive, and sort of this idea of like, you know, AI literacy doesn't have to be super deep and technical and out of reach. It's like you can sort of build this continuum. And, you know, Sally Holloway and the team there is doing amazing things. But yeah, if anybody listening is curious and wants to get in touch with any of those folks, we'd be, you know, Brad, I'm sure you and I would be happy to make some connections and facilitate, you know, more sort of cross-learning between districts.
Absolutely. And that's kind of one of the reasons I always kind of prod our guests, because you're right, and you're an authority in this space that I really want to make sure people hear. These are the vetted, trusted partners who have been in this work for, you know, longer than others, or really taking those next steps and trying to systematize and democratize, you know, AI access. So we always will include where you can find these amazing organizations and leaders that Alex just mentioned. So again, Alex, I want to thank you, and I'm going to turn it over to Rebecca to take us home.
Yeah. I don't have a whole lot to add. I learned a ton. I'm taking notes as we talk of things I want to look up for myself. You brought up so much good information, so many good organizations to check out. So thank you for being here with us. Thank you for being the driving force that brought this whole thing together. And we know how busy you are, so we really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
Welcome to your AI tip of the week. And I've got one that's kind of fun for you today. A new AI-powered tool from Apple, which is called Apple Invites. You may or may not have heard of this. I hadn't heard of it, which is why I'm sharing it. But it's a new app for invitations. So it allows iPhone users to create and share custom event invitations. You can create an invite, manage all the RSVPs, share event details via a link. And then at the event, all of the attendees can share photos and videos to a shared album and collaborate on the Apple Music playlist for the event. And they use AI-powered tools like Image Playground and writing to help make your event planning really, really streamlined. It's available on iPhone, but the people you're inviting don't necessarily need to have an iPhone. It just has to be managed on an iPhone. So it's free, it's available now, and it's definitely one of those little AI tips and tricks that will make your event planning hopefully a little bit easier. Enjoy.